Access granted.
Fuck you, machine.
Well, let's kick it off with Mitch's
the Google
voice.
Sentient AI.
I did say that. I read about that.
Pretty crazy. That okay, yeah, I'll start it off. Yeah, no, it's weird. I hope that it is just like cherry picked conversations, because for our sake, we're gonna have to worry about a new ethical quandary. Don't need any more of those.
I already work with Andrew. I don't need anything more.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. Let me know when we're ready to go. Are we starting?
Yeah,
recording. We started?
Good to go.
Okay. Hello, welcome back to the AltMed Cross Friendly Aussie podcast. We're back for part two. Andrew and Mitchell are back with us again. And we're just going to get right back into it. We're not going to waste any time. We're just having a free-flowing discussion, a bit like last time. How are you boys doing today, this week?
Thanks for having us back, Mitch and Josip. It's truly our pleasure. When you were giving that intro, I was thinking, which team am I on again? Am I part of Friendly Aussie or AltMed? And then I remembered, I think I am in AltMed, but if you guys...
Pretty sure you're the director there, right?
Well, if you've got any room in your team, I mean, wouldn't mind a break from Mitch, if I'm completely honest.
Come smoke some bongs with us. It's fine.
I wouldn't mind a break from Mitch as well, actually. So,
but, you know what? Me too.
But if you go to
maybe we all just swap. You know what I mean?
Swap one for one. We swap Mitches. That could work.
Yeah, we also put Andrew and Mitch squared. No, thanks so much for having us back, guys. We absolutely thrilled to just kind of dive in. There's been a little bit that's happened since we last spoke, so if you don't mind, I'm just gonna sort of
let us
kick
know.
Off with that. I want to talk a
We're
little
right
bit
into
about
it.
Thailand and ACT.
Oh yeah, some exciting stuff.
Sort of territories and jurisdictions have in common as a broad umbrella. I'm going to say they're both going in the right direction, but in different ways. So let's talk maybe first about Thailand. So as the kind of outlier now of Asia, what did you guys make of the news that Thailand looks set to basically set up a bit of a rec market?
Yeah, I'm fucking hell excited. One interesting thing that I know, we had John Tay on the podcast, and he's actually my doctor, Dr. John Tay. And he helped actually build in some of that legislation in Thailand. Like, he was one of the consultants in that, which was like mind blowing to hear.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love Tay. Brisbane also does legislative drafting in Thailand. That's quite impressive.
That's fucking.
He's all over the
good
place.
On your brizzy.
Yeah.
So I saw that, and then I was reading through things, and I saw a few people like bickering and arguing about the semantics, and they're saying, oh, you can't have any cannabis that's more than 2% THC. And I was like, no, that doesn't seem right. And then I think I found it was only concentrates are not allowed to be more than 2% THC. So if you're producing like an oil or an extract, but raw flower, there's no limits on it or anything like that. And then on Instagram, I've seen a couple little kind of cafe things pop up from Thailand, and people are selling things, but it's expensive. It's like $50, $60 Australian for like a 3.5 gram fitty bag. Kind of thought it would be a lot cheaper in Thailand, but maybe that's like a tourist shop or something like that. But still, damn.
That's interesting. I hadn't read the thing about it was only oils that couldn't be above that. So effectively, flower is a bit of a free-for-all. Is that right? Okay.
That's how I've managed to understand it anyway.
Well, it's CBD only currently, is what I read, below 0.3% THC.
But I think Josip's saying that's only for concentrates.
I think that's only concentrates.
Extracted oil. So flower might not have that rule applied to
really?
It.
Really? Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm getting my head around as well.
I mean, there's really one way for us to find out, which is that we all need to do a group trip over to Thailand and do a bit of a
recording. Thinking...
I'm in favor.
My birthday's in August, boys. Are we getting a private jet?
We'll see.
Split it like between 10 of us. It might be all right.
If we get another 100 subscribers on AltMed, it might be able to finance that, but we'll see.
Let's start a group Patreon or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Get all of our followers.
Putting out a bit of desperate call there. But no, I actually think it has serious potential to really transform tourism in that country. I know a lot of people will be really keen to go over there. I think it's sort of a step that I can see other countries and or regions, like maybe even Bali, as hard as that might be to square.
It's hard to imagine that one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, this is the thing. It's happening in a region, Southeast Asia, which is, you know, renowned for how strict and punitive they can be in terms of these sort of drug laws. So it's a really big step and a smart move for people who want to holiday over to Southeast Asia but aren't so keen on the idea of being thrown in prison and executed. I'm not over the detail with any of what's happened here, but
minimum benchmarks for holiday destinations. But I notice as well, like, well, Japan, I think for a little while, Japan has had a pretty liberal policy on CBD. I know that products have been available in a retail context there, but yeah, other than that, this really is quite an enormous step for that region.
Did anyone see the recent information around a news report about Malaysia ending the mandatory death penalty for non-violent drug crimes as well?
I didn't see that.
I haven't seen
so
that.
So that's a very new addition as well. And on top of that, I think Singapore and Vietnam and Myanmar are all increasing the death penalty usage for drug trafficking. So,
and you have Duterte in the Philippines as well,
who's recently been replaced by a guy who you would think the nickname of the new president of the Philippines, Bongbong, might be someone who lends themselves to very pro-drug policies. But sadly, I think he's following in Duterte's steps, perhaps not quite as aggressive as Duterte, but yeah, it's, you know, there is a long, well, it just by Thailand taking this action and passing this law, the gulf between Thailand and the rest of the region is just enormous. And what will be interesting is for all of those countries in Asia to actually see that, guess what? Nothing bad happens because of Thailand's law. So, you know,
are you saying that Bongbong got it wrong as well?
Oh God, really? How many minutes are we into this?
I think we can confirm that was the case.
Apologies to all of my listeners. I've let you down.
There'll be a written apology on the AltMed website going up later today.
Yeah, we'll put up a Mitch was sorry.
You know what I mean? Yeah, kind of like a Baz Lenko type thing going on here.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I think for a long time there's been a divergence between Thailand and other Southeast Asian countries on this issue. Even before, I don't necessarily think that they've had such a massive progressive step forward in this direction in their history, but there's in a different kind of approach and a different kind of different perspective on how these things should be treated. What's interesting about Thailand is that it has a monarchy and it's this kind of like constitutional system that I think operates slightly differently to its neighbors. And maybe that explains some of the differences in policy.
Absolutely. And it's generational within that monarchy because the former king of Thailand, I mean, some of the outpouring of grief that we saw when he passed away. And then, of course, his son, heir to the throne, takes over, is a young guy who I think was educated, you know, at one of those elite universities in the UK, probably Cambridge or Oxford or somewhere. And
right,
really sort of come back home to roost and has sort of said, all right, you know, here's a young set of eyes on the Thai economy. Let's look at ways we can bring more people here, and has brought about this this amazing reform. So that there's this really interesting story, and I tend to agree with you. I think the monarchy as opposed to perhaps a people's parliament, because we know that with Duterte, despite these insane policies, but from an Australian perspective, where, you know, people getting on very flimsy evidence told that they are, you know, drug dealers, or worse still, just in possession of drugs and
right,
facing potentially fatal consequences.
Pretty much a witch hunt at this
point. Yeah, totally a witch hunt, and you know, tens of thousands of people killed, and yet he enjoyed incredibly, you know, incredible popular support from the country. So it's you sort of think, well, perhaps you need just some interesting young.
This is the old Plato versus Aristotle, like philosopher kings versus, you know, a system of representative democracy.
Yeah, absolutely. A few years ago, actually, I was in Oman of all places, and the Sultanate of Oman, and Sultan Qaboos was hugely popular, a very beneficial ruler. And I was looking at the country and thinking, you know, is there no urge of determination from the people to sort of will a democracy into action? But they seem very comfortable. Like, I think a monsoon swept through Oman about 15 years ago, ruined heaps of people's cars. He just looked at the road register of all registered vehicles and replaced everyone's vehicle for them. So, you know, like that's just not going to happen in Australia.
Just to quickly
sadly
update the record, the King of Thailand actually went to UNSW. In 72. And then he went to a Thai university after that. But I just thought that was interesting.
No, thank you.
Interesting. But maybe he just got onto the Mullumbimby madness.
Yeah, no wonder he's all about it.
It was pretty crazy in the 70s, early 70s, New South Wales.
What I was going to say about like the Thai influence in Australia or
even that's massive.
The world in terms of cannabis is huge. You know, Thai land races are fucking well known. So I don't know, if he was here in the 70s, there probably would have been people bringing back Thai sticks, and he probably would have been smoking Thai sticks if he was smoking. So I don't know. I think Thailand's always had a really strong culture.
Like cultural connection.
And connection to...
We're having hoons on the podcast every week.
Every time. But
it's funny that the King of Thailand had to come to New South Wales to get Thai cannabis.
Yeah.
Back in the 70s.
That's
a long way to travel.
You know, they've got a long history of cannabis use within their culture. I think the precedent was there pretty easily. So I think it's...
Yeah, I've seen the beach. I've seen the beach. Yeah.
And then you've got so many expats that are in Thailand, right? And digital nomad types and things like that. It's like, these are the kinds of people, one, that can actually help bring these businesses up and support them. But when you're talking like ex-Americans and things like that, you know, they want their cannabis. This is a pretty awesome way. And then probably one of the other things, I think what the Thai governments probably realize realistically is, a lot of the cops will accept bribes for cannabis. Like, that's what I found in my experience is cops there, if you get caught with a fairly small amount of cannabis, you pay them $50 and they'll just leave you alone. Or they would allow you to have cannabis in sort of nightclubs or bars that kind of paid a bribe to cops to not, you know, enter or bother them. That's where they sold mushroom shakes and cannabis and all of that sort of stuff in Koh Samui and Phuket. Like, that's all pretty commonplace. It was all kind of done pretty openly anyway.
I am thinking genuinely of that movie The Beach with DiCaprio. It pretty much paints that picture pretty well. But it's you know, seeing it is hard to think of a native plant. Like, it's like eucalyptus for us. Imagine that being kind of illegal.
Wattle.
Yeah, I've never actually smoked wattle or eucalyptus. I don't imagine it would be as much.
You know, there's DMT in acacia.
DMT in everything, technically.
Yeah, but like large amounts, like, you could extract it.
Isn't there like DMT in cheese?
Probably.
Yeah, but with acacia, the acacia bark, it's something like 2% DMT. So when you fucking melt that all down and you synthesize it and all that, you get like a fucking return. People sell acacia bark.
I don't.
Oh, no, me either. Never done that. Never, ever.
Yeah.
DMT? Yeah.
That's just general information. Please do not apply it.
Melting down tree bark.
You need like a smelter. Yeah.
But people sell the bark on bloody eBay.
Really?
They do.
Yep.
That is very interesting. I thought you were going to say on the Silk Road.
No. Oh, if we want to talk dark web, this could be a good cast to have a little chat. I can talk dark web cannabis all day.
Can you actually? I haven't talked about dark web cannabis at all.
All right, before we jump,
let's go to ACT and then we'll go to dark web.
Yeah, and I just have one last thought on Thailand, which is just this idea of, you know, people go over to South America to do these, you know, ayahuasca spiritual retreats. And it's actually part of that country's tourism mix. And right. I guess I'm just thinking, can you guys sort of envisage, do you think, in all seriousness, is the fact that cannabis is now going to be legalized in Thailand just something where it's going to be available to purchase? Or do you see potentially people, you know, building resorts out of, you know,
their absolutely. I've already seen things being put into place for that.
Tourism is such a huge industry in Thailand. I can't see that not happening. In fact, it would be kind of like a sunny, like tropical Amsterdam if things go well.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Like, people go to Amsterdam seeking that kind of experience. There's no reason that that wouldn't be replicated if THC is available. Obviously, you're not going to have it in food products and that type of thing, but and the jury's a little bit out on the THC. I think from what I've read that you still can't have it as like a party drug.
Yeah, you're meant to use it medicinally, but I think that's pretty loose and lax.
Yeah,
yeah. I always use back pain when I'm out at the club.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, though, I've been dancing for 2 hours and fucking it's sore. Oh. Like, how is that not valid?
Well, so it sure beats getting it from the dark web. So take us through that because I've...
We can talk ACT afterwards.
It's I know Bitcoin's are a bit cheaper today as a result.
Shorting that market. But I mean, back, when was it? 2015, maybe even 14 to 16 or so. I was getting a bunch of bud on the dark web. And I mean, I guess that's incriminating myself a little bit, but come find it, you know,
for everyone can see that one on the AltMed, not the friendly Aussie buds. That'll be available for you.
That's so. Right. But more or less, there was a bunch of people on there that were selling buds. Some were scammers, some were not. Most of the time it was not, but maybe you didn't get what you thought you were going to get. So the reason I was doing it was there was nothing available in Brizzy that wasn't PGR, like at least that I could find. It was really, really, really difficult to find any sort of quality cannabis. Jump on the dark web though, fucking strains galore. Yeah.
Get hooked up by, what's his name? Dread Pirate Roberts.
Pirate Roberts, yeah. Love fucking Dread Pirate. But the Silk Road was like very, like people hold that in like a level of mysticism, like, oh, the Silk Road, and there was the Silk Road too. But the thing is, Silk Road was fucking small. There was like fucking heaps and heaps of other marketplaces that came along. The most notable that I think of is Alpha Bay. And there was a couple others and a lot of them actually exit scammed, which is basically where they took people's money and just fucking legged it because they had an escrow system. So if anyone's never used dark web or never looked into it, the way it worked is
sort of access via Tor browser or something.
Yeah. You jump on a Tor browser, go to a Onion link, and that would give you access to this website. You'd want a VPN doing it all. And you know, there's a whole bunch of security about it, but the way actually the payment worked is you would send Bitcoin or crypto of some form to the marketplace. So the marketplace would hold your money effectively like a wallet. And then when you purchase something, you would not send that money directly to the vendor. You would have it held up in escrow until you received it. And then you would mark that you've received it and then it would be released to the vendor. That escrow holding time though, fuck, there was millions of dollars. There were marketplaces that legged it with, there was one, I'm trying to remember the exact name. I think it was like Evolution, Revolution. I was online when it all went down. It was a fucking crazy shitstorm of a show. Like it was Reddit blew up over it, but they ran off with like $120 million worth of Bitcoin in like 2016.
Why wouldn't you do that if you were running like a dark web market? Because eventually you will be caught by the CIA, FBI, if you don't run and do it.
So you're talking $120 million then. That was when Bitcoin, I think, was around $1,000 a coin. Last year, we hit $69,000 a coin. You know, that could be literally billions of dollars at the moment that they ran off with. But more or less, I was just grabbing, you know, an ounce or so here and there of some nice quality. It was ranging anywhere from 180 to 400, 500 bucks. It was fucking pricey. I will give a straight up shout out to some guy called S.A. Great. He had the best weed I've ever had in my life to this day, hands motherfucking down. That's a really weird one. I went to Amsterdam. I've had, you know, a lot of the medical buds. I've had buds grown from exotic growers. This guy fucking shit on them all.
So do you know what strain it was?
This one that's in my mind, he had a bunch, but one was called, the Rugburn OG. It was a Cannabis Cup winner. It was a super diesel-y strain. It basically, you would inhale it, your mouth would go dry, right? And you could just, it was a very smooth smoke, and then you would exhale, and suddenly your mouth was just filled with saliva and you just started drooling, and it tasted like pure diesel coming out of your mouth. Like, we're talking the gassiest terps you've ever tried, hands fucking down. That to me was just unreal. That was the, like, him and like those dark web purchases were the first time I actually felt like I got to experience true cannabis. So the reason I talk fondly of the dark web, even though it was a fucking terrifying experience having to do it, it was actually part of the reason that led me onto the journey of wanting to, you know, make cannabis a little more mainstream and do all of that. Because I was like, the stuff people are smoking is not even cannabis in my eyes. If you're smoking PGR, that is not cannabis. That is balls of shit. I don't know how else to put it other than balls of shit.
Yeah. And it has to be said as well, you would think that from a law enforcement perspective, and I have actually listened to a great podcast, shout out to, I probably doesn't need a shout out, very popular podcast series, Case File, but I think did a 3-part series about Lord, what's his name? Pirate Roberts or whatever. And he was intercepted by agents at a library in San Francisco.
That's right. It's because he tried to apparently put a hit on someone.
He did.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So the story
and
was...
And that person was
FBI.
Fake.
Yeah.
Yes, it's coming back to me now.
Yeah.
He's still in jail, but effectively once they took over, you know, or were able to uncover everything that was happening on the Silk Road, I mean, from a law enforcement perspective, it would give you an idea of the size of the market, the amount of potential tax revenue that has been missed by the government. So I actually believe that even though, you know, they would look unfavorably, there's some really useful data there for them to digest.
Definitely.
Man, if you ever saw Alpha Bay in its prime, it was probably like 10 to 20 times bigger than Silk Road in terms of transactions and everything.
Really?
Huge, huge, huge. Wow. Yeah, there's been a few other ones. There was Agora. There was, I can't remember them all. They the exit scams happen pretty often. Like, you know, every probably once or twice a year, there'd be a marketplace that went, but there was always one that kind of rose to the top. And, you always kind of questioned when one exit scams a couple months later, you know, you've got another one popping up and it starts getting popular and you're like, is this the same people? It could be the same people. It's probably the same people.
I just wonder how people, you know, get that Bitcoin exchange for actual funds. Like how are you going to convert even $120 million of Bitcoin without it kind of showing up somewhere. I never understood that.
You can't. Like, that's one of the funny things about Bitcoin. While it's anonymous, it's also completely not. Everything in Bitcoin is traceable, you know. Mm. As soon as you transfer those funds, you can
back
see
into
where
US dollars.
Into. Yeah. Not even not US dollars, because what you would have to do to get off Bitcoin, if you boys aren't as familiar, I don't know if you guys are crypto nerds. I am. Basically, you would have to send from your wallet into an exchange wallet to be able to exchange it. But then
right. The
thing is, the exchange wallets are known by people. Like, the exchanges hold that wallet information publicly. Like, there's a public ledger to show how much money that they've actually got.
Yeah, but the only way you could do it is to literally transfer it to somebody for cash, basically.
Yeah, and that's the only way. Like, you'd have.
So how are you going to do that with, like,
120 mil, you just can't.
Well, and this is where I'm guessing, you know, just people have, you know, done it in bite size transfers.
Or they have links to organized crime.
That's another one. The other one is also tumbling it. So I don't know if you guys have heard much about tumblers. The idea is you put your crypto in and then it actually sends it to another address and it splits it off into lots of little bits and then it will send it to some other address and then you'll return and grab that coin into your new address. That way it kind of cleans it. But the thing is, tumblers, because they're built by someone, again, they could scam you. Like, you wouldn't run $120 million through a Tumblr, hey? Yeah. But, you know, if you're doing it in small bits and things like that. And also, if you ran off with that much money, do you really give a shit if you lose a bit here and there? Probably not.
We've gone completely off topic, but I am just curious about one other thing. Now that I'm speaking to a self-proclaimed crypto nerd, how do you even say you wanted to legitimately buy $120 million worth of Bitcoin? How do you do it, like, that transaction?
You have to go off exchange. You can't do that on an exchange because you'd influence the market a little too much. So you would talk to like a big investment firm that actually holds crypto, like a MicroStrategy or what's
Michael Saylor's. But how do they accumulate company? It? You know what I mean?
Like, well, they've bought it over a period of time. So Michael Saylor's company, he bought shitloads of Bitcoin at around $3,500. So they're holding, you know, I mean, now that it's at like about 21, 22, last I checked, their value's gone up at least, you know, 5-6 times. They've got a lot more. When it hit 69, they would have had a shitload more. So that's really all it is. It's just people hold it. The Winklevoss twins, they have an exchange called Gemini. They hold a shit ton of crypto. They're one of the biggest whales in the game. So, like, you'd kind of effectively be buying from people who are whales. That's how I would see it. And you'd kind of just negotiate a flat rate. Like, that's what Elon Musk ended up doing as well. When he bought it under Tesla, like, it was an off-market bid for, I think, $29,000. And the market was actually higher at that time, probably around 35, but that gave them the liquidity to actually do it. If he bought the amount that he bought at 35, the market probably would have gone to 25 or something like that.
So bringing it back to cannabis.
It's all right. I feel like, Mitch is starry-eyed. He's learning so much. I want to talk about the ACT because you would have seen there's a law that has been passed, I think, about effectively decriminalizing possession. So people then receive a civil penalty in the name of fine if you get caught in possession. And if, you know, it's there's no criminal charges that are laid that could implicate, you know, your future employment prospects or anything like this. Again, I see this as a, like Thailand, a step in the right direction. You know, good for people like Bailey Smith. Sorry, I'm not sure if any of you two follow the AFL, but
I do.
Recently caught, and there's just been a whole fanfare about
as long as he doesn't have more than a gram of meth.
Well, that seems reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, how big does his night want to be? No.
But, okay, how big does his week want to be?
Yeah. You know? How big can it be in ACT? I'm not sure. Is that...
I don't know. Has it all passed or are they just agreeing to it? Like,
I think they've just tabled the bill.
Yeah.
Maybe it has passed.
Yeah, so I think it was a private member's bill that was introduced by a Labor member in the upper house, Michael Pedersen.
Yeah,
we did. Who we've talked to. Him.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, I think ultimately, you know, this is a step in the right direction.
How does it end up being ACT that has this plus, you know, home grow amnesty on two plants? Like, why is it just ACT?
I think, is this where the conspiracy theory of it's for the benefit of the federal politicians
and their kids, maybe?
I'm not trying to propose that. I just don't understand why it's just that region.
There are a couple of reasons, I think. The first is that the ACT Legislative Assembly is quite progressive. You've got a fair few, they've got a Greens Labor government there. And so they don't necessarily have to worry about the same pressures as other states when it comes to regional areas versus urban area. You have Canberra and that's pretty much it. So it's almost like a local council. And the thing about the territory politics is that there's a level of autonomy there because they're subject to laws from the federal end. They don't have the state legislature. They don't have that same structure. So the federal government could step in and be like, this is not on ACT. We're going to roll this back. And I think that... that's almost like another check or another balance on top of this kind of progressive assembly pushing laws forward. And so they feel emboldened to actually give things a go. It's almost like a testing ground until the feds roll in and tell them to stop.
Yeah. Because states have, cool. States have more power under the constitution than territories, obviously. So under you know, the section 109 of the constitution, effectively a state can make its own laws. But if there's any inconsistency with a federal law, then the state law is null and void to the extent of that inconsistency. Whereas for any territory law, the Commonwealth government can effectively just veto it, to your point, Mitch. And I think that I agree. I think that there's always a bit of an appetite in the ACT parliament to challenge and see what they can do. They had their same-sex marriage laws in 2004 shut down by the Commonwealth government. But you know, more recently, the homegrow amnesty and now drug decriminalization, which looks set to go through. They've also had a bit of a change with a very conservative senator who was one of the two, because remember the territories, NT and ACT get two senators while the states, all six states get 12. Zed Seselja, I think his name is, Liberal senator. If you haven't heard of him, that's because he was rubbish and he did nothing. And no great loss at all to the parliament. He was the one that they actually sent to the Solomon Islands.
That's right. That's where I've heard that name.
Yeah. The China Security Pact. So good on you, Zed. Achieved absolutely nothing. Well done, mate.
Less than nothing.
I'll hear you on the way out. And welcome David Pocock, former Wallabies captain, who's... so nice youth injection there. I think as well, people forget that Canberra, which of course kind of takes in 95% of the ACT, has the highest median income and probably the highest levels of education of any city in Australia. So this kind of federal bureaucracy, people don't maybe appreciate it, is actually quite progressive. So, you know, it's no surprise off that, that you have a Greens and Labor government in the ACT. So
for sure.
Yeah.
I think it's a way for Labor to actually, not just test, but, you know, there are people all across the country who would like to see a bolder, more progressive Labor. And so if you have things happening in the ACT or in some of the states, maybe New South Wales, which are tending in that direction, I mean, they're not in power in New South Wales at the moment, but there are a lot of members of the New South Wales Labor Party, like Rose Jackson, who call for cannabis legalization. Yes. So, you know, you can really use that as a foundation for your federal platform or for election in other states.
And it's, I think we've all got to get used to this idea that as we see, at least in the current climate, things go in cycles. I'm particularly enthused by the current cycle we're in, where there is the rise and rise of you know, left-wing politics in this country and you know, kind of reduction in the power and influence of conservatives. I think this is a wonderful thing for, you know, policy areas around drugs to actually get the reform that they've so desperately needed. Unfortunately, we have been held back by a successive state and federal Liberal governments. And hopefully, you know, all of that might now improve, but, you know, we'll see. But I certainly think that it would be highly unusual for Albanese's government to veto anything that the ACT is doing, because I think that they're generally, if not, you know, inclined to adopt ACT policy federally, they're going to be respectful of what happens in the ACT. So, and you know, Michael Pedersen's doing a wonderful job. How was he actually on the podcast? Was he?
He's a good conversation. You should get him on AltMed. He'll probably happily do it. And he's, I think, did he tell us he was the youngest MP in ACT ever, or was that Australia? I can't remember, but it was he was like 27.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's crushing goals. I'm almost 30 and I'm not in parliament.
Mitch and I won't disclose how old we are, but we certainly didn't go into politics at that age.
I don't know if I told you boys last time I actually did run for the Legalized Cannabis Queensland Party for the state election in 2020.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, they've had a sharp increase at the most recent one. How did you go in 2020?
I think we got about 4% of the vote. I registered with about 3 weeks, I think, left on campaigning. So pretty much the last day you could do it. What was pretty funny though, I don't know if you guys know with the ballots, how like the order of the people get put on. It's not alphabetical or anything. It's like a ballot draw to see who's up top and it goes in order. I was number one. I was the first on the ballot, nice. Legalized Cannabis Australia, Queensland. And what I found kind of funny about it was like, fuck, do I want to vote for myself or do I want to take this ballot home? I voted for myself, but I kind of wish I took it home.
Did you at least take a photo of the...
I do have a photo somewhere in the phone of it. Yeah.
Yeah, nice.
I
would have voted one, Josip. Like,
oh, easy.
It was a pretty easy vote, to be fair.
It would have been quite funny too, because the electorate I'm in wasn't too far away from my high school. And I know there's a few high school teachers that are within the electorate. And I'm like, they would remember me. I used to cause so many problems at school. They would absolutely remember that fucking name. So I'm hoping they voted for me.
The guy who set off the smoke alarm or something. I don't
know. Nah, I didn't have cannabis until like 2 years after high school. I was so anti-drug. I played World of Warcraft and coded and hacked shit. That was my
high school. Like stoner activities to me. But
they fucking well were. It was World of Warcraft was my gateway drug to cannabis, quite honestly.
Fair.
Not even kidding. All the old guild members.
I played a little bit, but it wasn't my gateway drug. And it definitely wasn't my gateway drug to what is it, dark web or Bitcoin either. But I'm starting to get a good profile of you, Josip.
Just a bit of a delinquent, really? Like
digital delinquent.
Digital delinquent? Oh man, that'd be a good song title, don't you think?
It could be. Yeah, just like put it on your CV, you know.
Digital delinquent. I'll put it on my LinkedIn bio.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's the other piece of news actually that I did read during the week was about Germany planning to legalize cannabis. Yep. Did anybody see that come through?
Well, it's been happening for I don't know, maybe a year. They've been talking about it, like it's all been passed. I think they're just in the process of setting up all the regulation and getting it all. I think it's going to happen sometime next year. I think in June next year, maybe about a year away.
Yeah, they're planning for it. I mean, it's happening a bit in Western Europe. Switzerland is trialing adult use, Italy as well. The Spain situation is a bit interesting, but otherwise, you know, it makes me think if we had adult use in most of Western Europe and North America,
there's no way that doesn't come here.
Yeah, I just can't see. I mean, Australia's pretty protectionist, but. But in saying that, I do think it really bolsters the case for it in Australia.
I would agree. I think there's something to be said about, if not being like a client state, we kind of follow what happens in the Atlantic. They set the international agenda and we're like part of that whole system and we're beneficiaries of it. So, you know, as soon as that happens, particularly when it comes to like the UN treaty on drugs, when stuff like that is amended, I think you'll see that Australia will follow along. Whether that's, you know, before other nations or like well long after is really the question.
I think what I'd add to that is I think the really disappointing thing in our region is last year or the year before with I think it was the year before last with the New Zealand referendum actually not passing, you know. Yeah. I think that really set a negative precedence to us.
Well, it was very close. It was like 51-49 or something like that from memory. Like it was very super close. Super close. I mean, it was, yeah, slightly discouraging, but also
not unexpected. There was no support like we would have here in Australia in terms of an industry actually pushing it forward, because over there they didn't have a medical industry that actually had funds to be able to educate the population around what this bill would mean. In Australia, we've now got a whole bunch of medical companies. We've got doctors on board. We've got all of this. Mm. So, I mean, unless they've got obviously their own interests on keeping it medical.
They had a very strong pushback from religious fundamentalists as well.
That would be the same here. That would be the exact same.
I think it would be here. I just wonder if it would be as representative in as a percentage base that it was in New Zealand. It's hard to know until it actually happens, I guess.
Well,
the thing is, it would be weird because in order to have like a public vote on it, it would probably need to be some kind of plebiscite. I don't know if you could do, could make a constitutional change to trigger a referendum in Australia. So it would have to be some kind of non-binding vote, or the government just passes it. That's a weird one. Whereas in the New Zealand Parliament, I think they have different ways in which referendums work. They can bring direct ballots to the floor.
Yeah, they can. They've got a fantastic electoral system, actually. I won't go into the details of it, but yeah, someone that I follow actually did an amazing sort of number crunching with the recent federal election and said, you know, if Australia were the, you know, same system as New Zealand, here's what the results would have been. And I think it showed that we would have been even further to the left.
Right, yeah. They've got like proportional representation there.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. But no, I think that, you know, yeah, we could just see something akin to the plebiscite for same-sex marriage that was sort of released by the government in 2016 or 17 when they didn't have the courage to just pass amendments to allow same-sex marriage. But, you know, they use that as a basis. And I'm pretty sure polling actually just prior to that plebiscite was sort of saying, you know, 7 in 10 Australians support same-sex marriage. So it would be interesting ahead of a plebiscite to sort of see that polling done to see where Australia sits as it currently stands. I am really interested in what happens in Germany, because I think about all of the investment that's gone in on the medical side. And similarly, if we were to go that way in Australia toward recreational, do you think there would be pushback from the industry or certain players in the industry, because effectively they've sunk millions and millions of dollars to become a TGA licensed manufacturing facility? And you know,
I've had some thoughts on this. I imagine that whilst it might be made recreational, I'm not sure that the production level standards would reduce necessarily.
That's what I've had the thought on.
Well, if that, but I suppose the query I have there is, you know, what other food or, you know, what other non-pharmaceutical is required to be manufactured to pharmaceutical standards?
Well, we do have other standards like food safety standards, for example. There might be a food GMP. I mean, it does sit in its own territory to some degree.
How does alcohol and tobacco work?
Yeah, so tobacco is what I was going to say. An inhalable, for example, I actually don't know how tobacco, I'm not familiar with the regulations in depth, but I imagine that you could impose some kind of standard on something like cannabis beyond just food, let's say. And even food has safety standards, for example. So you'd be better placed to talk to that, Andrew. But
I'm not necessarily saying no standards. Of course, Australia loves rules and regulations and standards. I would expect it, but I just query whether or not TGA, you know, manufacturing licensed standards would apply, because yeah, the level of, you know, sterility is, you know, something that I'd be surprised if that were required.
That drop off.
I would be surprised too. I think that the thing about it is that you might not see so much ardent support of a bill like that, because you already have an existing status quo that suits those companies. So they may not be the ones at the forefront of this push or this change.
Yeah.
But the other side of it is that because we have that system of medicinal cannabis, it's been somewhat normalized within our society at this point. So, you know, it's like how California had like a functional medicinal system for a long period of time. Now their medicinal system was a lot different to how ours is currently set up, had a lot less regulation. But what that effectively did was it prevented California from legalizing recreationally long after other states like Colorado, etc. Mm-hmm. So I think that might be the effect of what we're currently going through. But who knows, maybe there is a business opportunity in, even with the, you know, reduced standards of a recreational market, where these companies who have built the facility already have a head start on literally everybody else, could just pivot to doing the other, you know?
Or both. What if we had a system where it allowed for kind of both, you know, like the medical space, because you had like such a level of scrutiny and stuff like that, you knew it was a higher quality or supposedly a higher quality than what you'd get maybe on the rec market. And potentially you would have, you know, medical patients actually still going through a medicinal program. It would probably lax up a lot to where it is now, maybe a down scheduling from an 8 to a 4 or something in that regard. But
post office closes at 5.
I'm just trying to make it express. I just want express legalization.
I think that in America, you still have the two systems kind of on a state basis where you have medical and recreational. Just taxed
differently, I believe.
They don't have pharmaceutical grade manufacturing to the same extent that.
Very true.
I think they do have some facilities that produce that type of quality, but very
few. I don't think so. Far between. Because in the States, right? The states are so secular. I don't think a state is allowed to ship it from one state to another, nor overseas.
They're not. So, but still,
do you think they're GMP certified?
There's definitely GMP facilities in the states that are producing a different quality cannabis, but that's only to service their own state. You got to remember, some of those states are bigger than Australia in terms of total population. Yeah, sure.
I think Colorado is like 20 million just on its own, right?
Yeah, I think California is like 43 or something like that. That could be, I could have that wrong, but I think it's something like that.
It's huge.
It's you know, it's like, well, what's the, if you're a company looking and investing, like, why would you even bother in Australia when you've got a market twice the size in a single state like that? I did have another point. For example, so if you're thinking about the distinction between potentially a recreational market and a medical market and how they can work together, for example, I believe Switzerland's trialing adult use, but it's capped at 20%, for example, THC. So it's like maybe there's a market where anything under like 15% is adult use, and anything over that's like a 50% or you want to hash, it needs to be, you know, a medical system and maybe some oversight on that, which kind of makes sense. And to be honest, I'm not really interested in anything over 20% myself, because I just don't think that the THC equates to the necessary outcome I'm looking for. It's much more.
I agree with you on that. What if it's something that's like 22 and you do agree with it, you know, like,
Look, I'm not setting a hard and fast rule on the percentage, but I'm just using it as an example of what might be some kind of happy medium. Like maybe, you know, you can't go to the liquor store and buy isopropyl or, you know, methylated spirits, let's say, to drink. You know, there's this kind of delineation between what's acceptable in that sense. And yeah, you can get cask strength or whatever whiskey, which is like up at 60%, but I'm just trying to create a little bit of a paradigm where you could have them coexist in a way that was delineated by certain factors such as THC content. I can't think of anything else that's really.
What about, I'm just thinking of, you know, you go to the dried herbs section of your supermarket, you know, and I get oregano, or I get, you know what I mean? Like,
I don't think that will ever happen. I don't think we'll get that here.
Well, where, you know, let's just have some consistency, please, TGA. Let's have the oregano made in GMP pharmaceutical facilities. No.
I want quality herb.
No actives. I get it.
We don't have time for that.
Oh, no. Again, the apology that we'll be posting will.
I'm a serial offender.
Yeah. Oh wait, I just got that.
I just got it as well.
Oh, welcome. Yeah. Welcome, friendly Aussie buds.
How many kids do you have?
Mixing up his comedy. Variety is the spice of life. Okay. That's different.
I think it's the distinction between medical and recreational. It's such a blurry line, and it's a little frustrating as like an end cannabis user of hearing kind of the discussions, because you're like, it's the same bloody plant. You're kind of getting the same outcomes. It's just, you know, what does that plant do for a particular person?
Different use cases for sure, right? Like, you know, that's why they're separated. Like, they are the same plant, but they're developed and are cultivated for different ends, right? But the ends often overlap. It is a bit of a Venn diagram. So the question is, how do you sustain one industry and then boost up or, you know, launch another without them kind of cannibalizing each other? And I think what you brought up, Mitchell, is probably some kind of step towards it. You would need to figure out like what is the like qualitative or even just like what's the factor in terms of something that we can measure that allows us to create that distinction.
Yeah,
and allow these things to exist.
I mean, I remember the first time I got to the States to when it was legal, after it being legalized, because I went when I was a lot younger. But I got there and I was actually working on one of the family farms in Washington State, and I met all the crew that were working there. And the first thing they did was bust out their dab machines with like 70, 80% resin. I just thought to myself,
fuck,
holy shit, this is just... this didn't feel like smoking a joint. This felt like the heroin of cannabis, if that made sense.
The meth yeah. of cannabis.
And I was just like, I don't think I actually know I don't need this amount of THC for me. Like, and so I'm just trying to think like that, that's not something that, I mean, some people love it for sure. I get that it could have isolated medical purposes, but I don't personally, I'm not in support of that being a widespread usage of cannabis for me. I mean, it's a personal view, but I just don't think it's necessary for your average person enjoying it recreational. It's like, yeah, it comes back to that kind of isopropyl conversation where it's, do you really want people drinking 60, well, that's 98%, but like 90 proof or whatever it is, 180 proof, 100, I'm getting confused with the proofs, but 99%
alcohol.
Yeah. Does anyone really need more than, I mean, I'm going to say it's, I'm already going to start high, but more than 60% alcohol? Like,
no, it's a really good point. But then what you're dealing with is people who will probably go ahead and do it anyway. So you've got a paradigm right now where you have like unsafe concentrates as a result of people trying to get those high levels of THC and just fucking up the process because it's not regulated in any way, shape or form.
I get what you're saying, but at the same time, like you can go and drink isopropyl. Like,
right, but develop your own moonshine.
Yeah, and you can do that if you want, but it's like you look at those people and you're like, yeah,
more fucked.
Yeah, you're that's actually what I would say, actually, the technical term. But you know what I mean? There is the official
medical term, yeah.
There's a social delineation between people who sit there drinking moonshine at the party versus somebody who's come and had a beer. Like, yeah. I think that, sure, there's going to be people that do it. There's going to be people that, you know, drink that super concentrated or smoke the concentrate or make whatever, but I don't necessarily think it should be wrapped up in that rec medical kind of sense. It shouldn't be, you know, what we accept as normal, the common usage of cannabis.
But to counter that, here's kind of the thing that I've seen with concentrates, right? So you have your dab material and you're talking 70 to 90%. Like I've seen live resins go 90% plus. Now it sounds absurd, and that would be absurd if you were to take like quite a big chunk of it and have a dab. But what if you have an e-pen that you actually put a little dot in and you're actually taking puffs of it like a vape cart and you're actually just loading it up yourself, so you're not using the disposables, which you end up throwing into landfill. Right. But the thing is, you'd still have to sell that concentrated product to be able to allow people to do that. So then they can abuse it.
I don't think the recycling component as the strongest argument there isn't strong enough for me. I still think, you know, even a 40% or a 20%, you're still going to get a desired effect.
You've had cartridges, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you took, you know, 2, 3, 4 puffs, 5 puffs on one, you normally get like, hey, how you going? Like it gets you pretty good, right? You're not suggesting that we made those only medical and that's not on the rec market? Because I think that's probably one of the best ways to actually introduce someone to cannabis is giving them 1, maybe 2 puffs of it and then seeing how they feel. Quick come up, short come down.
Yeah, but I still think you can cap that out at a percentage and still get the desired effect. Like if you have to take a couple more draws.
But then effectively say you've got a 1 full mil cartridge, right? Or a 1 gram or a half, right? The Urban Leaf ones that are coming from Canatrek, they're a half mil with 400 milligrams or 200 milligrams and 200 milligrams of CBD, THC, CBD, right? But if you were to make that weaker, you're going to go through that way, way, way quicker. And then the cost of, you know, production, like I said, the disposableness, but the whole point of those is you only need one or two little puffs and you're getting medicated or, you know, inebriated, depends on which way you want to look at it. I don't think lowering the percentage is going to give you the desired outcome because you're just going to have people hitting them more or buying more of them.
Well, I mean, if recycling is really your gripe, then, or you know, the landfill element, then just make them reusable, ban disposable.
Yeah, but to make them reusable, you would have to sell that concentrate.
What's interesting about this concentrate stuff is that you see a parallel in terms of what's happening in terms of like e-cigs at the moment and how the government is attempting to make that a prescription medication.
Not attempting. They've done that.
Well, they have. Yeah.
They're right. But there's a massive loophole out the back allowing people to import them bulk and then sell them illegally. So that's happening a lot as well.
Import them, yes. Not sell them.
Yeah, of course. But it's happening.
Yeah.
Illegally.
It is definitely happening. Although I must say, it seems like the TGA's efforts have been largely more, they've been taking a lot more enforcement action, let's say, on nicotine than they did on cannabis, at least in the early stages. Seems like they're very much more well-resourced and funded to do that. So I'll be interested to see how that goes over time because it feels like they're cracking down. And, you know, for a long time, people thought that the TGA was a bit of a toothless tiger to some degree, but they're definitely, at least I've been reading about it a lot more, especially with nicotine.
I have sympathy for the fact that it's always a bit of a whack-a-mole exercise from the regulator's perspective because, you know, whack one, someone else pops up. But yeah, I agree, Mitch. I think the TGA has started, you know, pretty forcefully with, you know, with the new nicotine regulations. And yeah, it's a bit more of a tricky space too, because yeah, you have more retail access still, despite the fact that it's illegal, to nicotine vaping products. Whereas I think CBD oil, generally the black market existed online, unless you go to the Mullumbimby markets or something like this. But it's generally, yeah, so I think it's an interesting space to watch, actually.
It is. You know, the thing about that is that if you have the opening up of the recreational market, I think you're actually doing like a Pandora's box. I don't necessarily think or believe that you're going to be able to enforce those caps without putting a lot of resources and time into enforcing those caps, because there are going to be people doing what is currently happening now, even with a highly resourced TGI trying to shut it all down. But with cannabis,
you're always going to have some people that skirt it. I think the mass manufactured products, you wouldn't do that if you're a listed company or anything like that. You wouldn't have it. So the big brands, the ones that are going to be at the corner store, the Woolies equivalent or wherever it ends up, that's just not going to be what you're going to get. You'd never walk into a liquor land and find a 90. Well, actually, I haven't actually checked that, so I can't tell you for certain. There might be a couple of, rogue alcohol products that sit up there, but I think you catch the drift of what I'm trying to say.
I think
that the general, 95% of the market will be that. And then you can go to Mullum for the rest of the stuff you need, or ACT apparently. Yeah,
no, that's fair.
If we choose to go down the big business route, I think, for a recreational legalization.
I don't think it will ever not be big business.
I think that
I agree.
True. I agree that way with Australia. But if we have decriminalization laws hit in where people can grow their own, there's going to be a definite gray market, I think, that exists. I went on a podcast the other week, Hillbilly's House. I don't know if you guys have seen him about. Interesting character, really.
I've heard of this, actually.
Yeah. And he was telling me about how South Australia used to be. He's like, people used to openly sell cannabis at markets there. Mm. Like, it was, the laws were like quite lax. Smoke shops and stuff like that, you could buy edibles from them for a long time. And even to this day, apparently, like, the under the table, they'll sell you flowers, buds, edibles, gummies, like whatever you need, really. But back in, I think it was like 2004 or that area, for like 5-10 years, you'd go to the markets and there'd be people literally with buds out on the table selling buds, like openly and honestly. And I'm like, I grew up in the wrong fucking place, didn't I?
No, that is, that is genuinely fascinating. I mean, I think, you know, like a lot of people I see as, you know, coming full circle and, you know, 5 years from now, say, having a recreational market of some sort in Australia. And there's a great book to be written at some point about how all of the different states and territories all tried different things and all moved at different speeds, but we kind of all ended up maybe in the one place at the end of it all. But that's very intriguing.
The other option is we go the Spanish route. I really like it, to be honest. It's probably my favorite model around the world. It's kind of like the pot clubs.
Spain or Portugal?
Spain. So Spain has the pot clubs where you have to become a member to be able to purchase from there, and all the cannabis is actually grown by the members of the club. So to me, that's a really great system. I don't think we'd adopt that in Australia. We don't really have that kind of camaraderie that I think,
everyone would be trying to get in like Tom Forrest's club and,
mate, I would definitely be opening up fabs.
Yeah. You can get lost in the forest. I don't know. I still can't see it. I still can't see it not being big business. Even if people can grow their own, like I can cook my own foods, but you don't want to see my Uber Eats bill. Like, you know what I mean? It's just like,
till you grow your first plant, you'll be like, oh damn. Like talking from personal experience. Woo.
That's fun I've ever had. I've grown plants for sure overseas, not in Australia, just for anyone listening. But I've got a lot of experience with that. I think that, and you know, I love cooking as well, but I still do order.
You still, 100%. It wouldn't go away entirely. You know what I mean? No way.
You know, and you still, even if you're cooking and you're choosing the ingredients, you still go to specific places to get certain ingredients or maybe a side dish that's finished. Or I just can't see it not being mass manufactured. And, you know, you finding your own favorite, you know, micro grow cultivator or something like this, like a Cooper's Palau, which is now, you know, one of the biggest.
You're speaking to my heart here. I'm a Cooper's man through and through.
Yeah, but that's not really a microbrewery anymore.
Not anymore.
You know what I mean? Yeah. But if you do something well, you do something successfully, I still see it becoming big business because people want, you know, quality in it. And I think that will rear its head one way or another and it turns into, you know, high demands and big bucks. So, which makes, you know, the price should technically go down and all these kind of, you know, general economics, which I probably don't need to get into right here because it's basic stuff. But what I'm trying to say is essentially, yeah, big business and cannabis, I just can't see them separating, fortunately or unfortunately.
It's a bit of both.
I reckon you're right in the sense that it's probably unavoidable within the current dynamics of the marketplace. And it might even be a good thing. There might even be benefits to having large corporations roll into Australia or be set up in Australia for these purposes. But the question is, what happens to that boutique, artisan or small business space when the recreational industry opens up? And that is really yet to be seen. It's going to be completely dominated by large corporations due to the way in which it's set up, or is there going to be a kind of local homegrown tinge to what's actually happening?
Well, I think you'd end up having both. I mean, in a rec market, I imagine, or in that kind of circumstances. And there's always a place for your you know, Coles brands or whatever. And then there's always a place, you know, Andrew's got a place here. He goes to get specific drinks in you know, where is it? Preston? No, Northcote.
Oh, yeah.
Carwin Cellar or whatever it is. You know, you'll travel to those places to get that specific thing. Or only drink and stock up and have that because you care about having all organic, or you care about, you know, having sustainably farmed.
Yeah, if they let you, you know, if they let, you know, mum and dad growers say actually do their thing. Whereas I think that the concern that I have is that, you know, because there's been so much investment from the pharmaceutical sector in establishing these facilities, that they might just say, all right, we'll legalize it, but it has to come from one of these facilities. Otherwise, you know.
Can they say that it has to come from one of those facilities? I mean, we've got a license. They can
say that easily. Yeah, absolutely.
They would have to be in on the ground push in terms of legalization. Like they would have to be the ones lobbying for legalization.
Hold on. I mean, Do you mean that they could actually restrict it to a few sellers, or are you saying that that make it price prohibitive in setting up costs?
I think the latter.
Because you know, the former of what, like, for example, we have a license, so we can import and supply, and
sure.
In fact, we do. But it's just like, unless you go through that rigmarole, you can't do it, right? And I'm are you saying that the rigmarole in this case would be prohibitive to people, or are you saying that people actually won't have the ability to do that because it's confined to several operators?
Well, let me just say it's an offence to possess 50 kilos of potatoes in Western Australia if you're not appropriately licensed. And I cite that as one of many strange laws in this country to say that
that's, if they
want
to draft
legislation to that effect, they can just do whatever they want. You know, like, I mean, obviously, if it's, you know, there are grounds to challenge laws, but I am suggesting that, you know, if they want to set the quality standard that high, that it has to meet all of the same things that only a licensed TGA manufacturing facility operates to, then of course they could do that.
Right. But you could still have people coming in that do have the money, or consortiums, let's say.
Right. Yeah.
Coming in.
You wouldn't restrict the industry that way. I think that would be ridiculous.
Yeah. So what you're saying is you can't just grow at your, you know, farm. And
yeah. Well, you know, just to some extent, you know, I guess if I, you know, you might be driving along the highway and someone's set up, you know, buy oranges, buy the 10 kilo lots or whatever. And
just not potatoes.
Where's your license for that?
It depends if you're in WA, but you know, you have that, and it's all completely unregulated. You know, there's no food labeling laws that apply to what
I've, I mean, I've personally never grown more than 49 kilos of potatoes.
Well, then you're fine.
Oh man. Once you get to 51, the game changes. Let me tell you.
Absolutely.
It actually does.
Yeah, only the biggest spuds are in that game. But, yeah. Sorry. But,
don't apologize. That was a good one.
Oh, so he's all right.
Yeah. No. When you come up with a good one, I'll let it pass.
We'll acknowledge it. Yeah.
When none of the comments thus far have made the cut. But okay.
Keep trying.
I think what I kind of come back to with this kind of conversation is it really comes down to maybe if there's different licensing schemes, if they would allow for potentially like a smaller license grower instead of, you know, maybe a $1 million setup, it's 20 grand or something like that. And they still have to go, you know, get their things tested. And there's a lot of that process involved, but it allows for maybe a smaller scale, that boutique grower to still somehow enter the market. I think it'd be very... very unfortunate if we didn't allow for that to happen, because that's kind of just stopping innovation and entrepreneurism and all of that. Will Australia do that? Good chance. I could absolutely see that. You know, we're not necessarily the US when it comes to business, where it's guns ablaze and let's go. And then just on top of that, when we've been talking about TGA and all of that, I think with the rec market or even the medical, I think this could maybe move towards there. Is what the Greens are proposing, some sort of cannabis federal
agency.
Body agency that is actually the regulator, people who understand cannabis and that's all they actually do. I think that would maybe allow for the smaller growers to come in when they're not necessarily a GMP facility, but they can be tested like they're a GMP facility to make sure that the quality of standards are actually there and all of that.
I'm curious to hear on that. Andrew's perspective on that, because, you know, setting up a whole regulatory body for a new industry or a new, industry, that's what it is actually. You know, how is there an example of that that's occurred?
Plenty of times. Yeah. I mean, they set up the Office of Drug Control purely to have a government agency administer Australia's obligations under the international, you know, drug treaty of 1967. So yeah, that's absolutely a thing. I could very much see something.
Oh, so let's just do that then.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a bad idea either. It's really just the details. And because we are still living in hypothetical land when it comes to all this stuff, it's not clear what that would look like. But my ideal scenario as well is that we you know, develop an agency that actually, you know, independent and is able to, you know, approach the cannabis industry on its own standards and really engage with it in a way that makes sense and isn't just like tied up in bureaucratic nonsense. Because then that would allow for the kind of common sense decision-making mechanisms to flow down into these institutions. But for as long as we have, you know, I'm not saying that everything with the TGA is wrong and bad. I think there's been some great things that have occurred out of the current structure in terms of medicinal cannabis. And there have been some reforms around the edges that have been made. But when we're talking about a kind of expansion into a broader spec than just medicinal cannabis, I think that that sort of approach would probably be required.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All in agreement. Yeah.
That's good. Well, I'm glad we got here.
I'm happy to put my hand up for a director seat. That's cool. No worries. I'll be on
totally
that
unbiased.
I will happily be a product tester. It's all good. I got it. I got you, Australia.
Fit and proper person tester.
I think so. Yeah. Got the experience that we need, you know.
Yeah.
I just think, look at me.
That's actually the official garb of the institution. Of the tribe. I think. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Drug rug.
Oh dear.
I think one of the big issues fundamentally stopping us from all of this is to actually just have this all discussed. I think that's kind of maybe where we'll see some movement. We've got more Green senators than we've ever had before. There's more Greens members in the federal parliament. You know, this is one of their policies that they've been talking about for maybe the last 3-4 years. When did they launch Just Legalize It? Was it 2019? I think that was it.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But I know that Di Natale's been talking about it since he got in.
He talked about it, but it wasn't officially Greens policy, I think, till 2019. I think they were talking about decriminalization. They weren't like, yeah, let's legalize cannabis till I think the 2019 mark. And now that we've got a bigger body, Mitch probably knows this pretty well, Fab Mitch.
I'm not Fab.
You are Fab. You're definitely Fab. It's fine.
Pre-Fab.
The hair is pre-fab. Definitely Fab, you know?
I got someone came up to me the other day and just, they said, hey, mate. I'm like, hi. And he goes, just want to tell you, you've got effortless actor hair. I'm like, nice. Cheers, mate.
Very true.
It's very nice.
Very true, Mitch.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Have you ever starred in anything?
Starred?
Yeah.
The Alt-Med podcast.
Yeah, my own. Yeah, the Alt-Med podcast.
Quite an IMDb profile there.
The Fab podcast.
Yeah, true.
It's actually the Fab. It's the Fab.
The Fab.
When he was younger, he was occasionally confused for Prince Harry, but, you know.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. It's definitely the hair. Yeah. Sorry, we interrupted you, Yosef.
Yeah.
Actually, Yosef, I have a question for you. Do you think that the Greens vote at the most recent election was helped by the fact that Clive Palmer, I think, unintentionally helped them out by saying, if you want free marijuana and the dole for life?
I don't know.
Like, free advertising.
Is that supposed to scare people off? Dole for life and free marijuana? Really?
If you Google Clive Palmer cannabis banner, is it up there? Hold on. I'm just checking the images. I'm just doing a quick Google search because we did this little meme at the last federal election. You know, all these like yellow banners. What was it? Make Australia great again.
Yeah.
We edited it and made it Make Australia Green Again.
Nice.
So if he spent on cannabis as he did his own thing, he probably could have made great change in this country and he would have probably got the legacy he wanted. But unfortunately, he didn't. Piece of shit.
I have to say, though, like, he's a visionary. I mean, the dinosaur park that he...
I mean, it is pretty sick. Let's not lie.
You know. No, but I absolutely do think that there is a wave of reform happening right now, which means that things are being discussed openly. It's not political suicide to even just entertain policy discussions. It's a great time to be in Australia, really.
I agree. The atmosphere has changed.
Except for the rising cost of living, the stagnated wages.
Yeah, the global economy.
Yeah.
Guys, that's not an issue. We have a solution. It's literally cannabis.
Yeah, totally.
How are we going to bring money into this industry, into this country? Just straight cannabis. Like, my God.
It's the cannabis-fueled recovery.
The cannabis-fueled recovery. That. We're all about that biodiesel, eh?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That endocannabinoid rebalancing, I believe, is how they refer to it.
I saw on
base cannabis, load CBD. Yeah.
I saw on cannabis that the ETAA or ETAA, the Emerging Therapeutics Association of Australia, is looking to have a meeting with the new Labor government as soon as possible, basically asking for regulatory consistency for medicinal cannabis, patient and prescriber education, supply chain efficiency, transparency, you know, changing the controls around it. So basically trying to have the Albanese government actually start talking to the industry and, you know, putting in some suggestions on how it could be better and all of that. I think that's going to start a lot of these talks. Maybe, you know, maybe legalization is a little more further away than we expect, but I have a feeling that the medical industry is going to be loosened up a lot more over the coming months and years.
Okay. Yeah, now that they're in power, I think that's fair.
What was that? Sorry?
Who was that was lobbying for those changes?
The ETAA, the Emerging Therapeutics Association of Australia.
Kronos, some a lot of that crew, because when you type in ETAA, you get the Equine Therapies Association of Australia, and I think that's more like... Horses or something.
Yeah. Slightly bigger rep do they have? Yeah.
Having a quick look at who's
all
on
things
board.
Being equine. Sorry.
Didn't load up. Their website loads like crap. They need to fix it.
Yeah. Well, it would be interesting to see what kind of reform, you know, that they're proposing for the medical space. I know that we're about to see in the next 12 months the full changes coming into effect with the amended TGO 93. So, you know, people can expect to see that, which effectively levels the playing field, quote unquote, in respective manufacturing quality. So all products will need to be GMP from 1 July next year.
Right.
But it's certainly, I do not believe, or I don't subscribe to the idea that that's going to eliminate imports. I think there will still be very much a role for imported products to play in the Australian market.
There's probably a demand for it that won't go away.
Yeah. I think we can supply. I mean, we probably could supply. Apparently we send most of our cannabis overseas anyway.
I think you'll find an amalgam approach emerging where you'll see, depending on where the cannabis the product is in its development, you'll get it at a certain point imported to Australia and finished here. So you'll get flowers and different oils that come in from overseas and get finished in Australia in order to be compliant. There's different
stages.
That's
interesting.
In terms of like actually packaging it up and weighing it and all of that.
Yeah. So GMP only applies at a certain part of the actual process. So at a certain point you'll have stuff that's imported and then before that process requirement and then made into a product in Australia. So I think that will be an area of development, let's say. And then you'll obviously have products from overseas that do meet GMP coming in. But that last one from my perspective, the first one I suggested from my perspective will be where you get more interesting or more different products, let's say.
Given that you have a license to, you know, I guess supply yourselves with these sorts of products,
not to supply ourselves, to supply.
Unless your doctor prescribes your product to you, right?
Well, that, yeah.
That's allowed. That's allowed.
That's fine.
That is allowed. But you know what I mean.
Sure.
If like you have that kind of insider knowledge of it, is there anything that you can kind of see happening within the next couple of years to shake up or kind of like fundamentally change that space? Is there anything that you're privy to in terms of developments in those medicines, particularly what you've got access to right now?
I don't think there's anything we're privy to that the general public isn't privy to with enough research, if that makes sense. The fact that we live and breathe it today, excuse the pun, means that we're across.
That was good.
Means that we're across what's happening just by virtue of the fact that we discuss it with lots of, you know, different, let's say, stakeholders on a day-to-day basis. So we're, and it's in our interest to keep abreast of that so that we know what we can and can't do. And we have to,
of course, yeah,
basically come up with these different ideas to make sure that what we are doing is compliant and legal. So, so from that perspective, no, we're not privy to anything, but yes, do we think about it more than the average person? We do. So I mean, we can be included on consultations as we have been in the past, you know, that the TGA takes recommendations from industry parties, just as they would, and I guess any interested member or somebody who's got some kind of bearing or interest in the industry. So from that perspective, arguably, but I wouldn't say that that's, you know, anything that's given us great kind of insights beyond what other people might have. We do spend a lot of time, you know, reading regulations and laws and, you know, the PICS guide to GMP manufacturing, if you want a really boring read.
I jumped in just to say that, you know, for example, if, you know, in a hypothetical scenario where, you know, the Australian domestic market might have some key growers who are supplying flower products for a range of different cannabis companies, it might be the case that, you know, in Australia, through all of those different cannabis companies, only somewhere between 5 and 10 cultivars are likely to sort of make their way to an end user and patient.
Wow.
If, you know, in that scenario, then of course, you know, imported products might be able to provide more than that. But it's, you know, of course, going to be the case that from July next year, those imported products will need to meet the, you know, the GMP standard. And that becomes a tricky ask if the country from which they're being imported doesn't.
Hoons. Hold on. Let's pause for the hoons.
We might be here for a long time.
Yeah.
That guy used to sit on his bike at like 7 in the for morning like 10 for like minutes. 10, 20 minutes. And you're like, what the fuck, bro? Like, why?
Yeah.
Hates the earth.
Yeah.
Hates himself, really.
At least you know this is a raw, authentic kind of podcast. You know, where you get the real word on
the streets of Annerley.
Having a good old screen.
Yeah. But, yeah. Was that I thought it was a parrot or something like that.
Yeah. We have a parrot downstairs. He's a Quaker.
Literal Quaker.
He's a Quaker.
That's just makes like ear piercing noise. It's great.
Yeah.
My partner isn't home, so she's not taking care of the bird to be quiet because he's just feeling lonely. It's evening time and he needs to cuddle up.
Poor guy. He's got needs.
He has needs.
I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah. Well, we feel bad. I want to release you to the Quaker and just want to say, very much a huge thank you. I just was contemplating, like, we've covered so much ground. We started at Thailand. We went dark web, ACT, 50 kilo bags of potatoes in WA. I
mean, kind of the highlight of the conversation.
You've taken us around the world. We've seen the sights.
Yeah, we've seen all the sights.
We've eaten the potatoes.
We've covered Labor Party, Liberal Party, United Australia, legalized cannabis, Greens.
Yeah.
We've hit a few topics here.
You're so right.
We've also created a bit of a vision, I think, of like thoughts of vision anyway, of where the industry could go. I think that's pretty much been the driving force of this discussion. It's like, where are we going with this whole cannabis thing here?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, when you just perceive the world as we know it day to day, it's interesting to put yourself in 5 years from now and sort of looking and saying, okay, so what could we do in that intervening period such mm-hmm. that my outlook in 5 years is going to be totally different and the outlook of the people that are in my world is going to be different too. So,
and most importantly, yeah, for people listening on Spotify or Apple or anywhere else, that they now know to watch the YouTube to see the effortless actor hair. So, you know, there's been quite a bit that has been really important message, key messaging that has come out tonight. So I'm very, very,
you need to get yourself happy. a hair mitt, you know,
so a hair net.
Not a hair net, a hair mitt. It's a helmet that has space for your hair, so it never gets compressed. You know.
Do you have one of those for your beard?
No, we just put a COVID mask down there. You know, just keeps it in check.
Nice. Actually, so I was visiting an anonymous cannabis facility recently in Queensland, and one of the growers had a big burly beard. And when we went into the sterile area, he put a hairnet on his chin.
Yes, I had to do that actually.
I couldn't stop laughing. I thought it was
to do that. I went to a farm as well. A few years back, and I had to bloody do that, and I was like, well, this sucks, this is really uncomfortable, hate to work in these conditions.
You definitely have to shave it, I reckon, if you work there full time. But it was what would you look like shaved? Probably
terrible.
Okay,
it's terrible. Don't do it. Just don't do it. It's not worth it.
All right, I promise I won't do it.
neither will I.
Well, thank you so much for your time. Trust we'll speak again soon. We definitely should. Very, very easy to chat to you guys. And
great, it's fun.
Very grateful for the collaboration. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, cheers. And we wish you well with all of your various ventures. It's really exciting that you guys are pushing forward just the space in general, and we back you 100%.
Yeah, bring on those OG genetics. Likewise. Thank you.
Yeah, we might be looking at doing that. So, keep you posted.
Yeah, nice. All righty. Thank you.
Thanks, lads.